office. Malaysia Kini is secular, although editor Stephen Gann has asked me not to use that word because he says it will get him in trouble, because in Malaysia nobody's supposed to be secular, everyone's supposed to be religious. Well, I'm using the word anyway. As those of you who study Malaysia know, that Islam in Malaysia is unavoidably political. For me as a researcher, a big difference between Indonesia and Malaysia was that in Indonesia, everyone was willing to talk to me about religion. In Malaysia, the first question I got was, why do you want to know? And then the second statement was, well, I'm not the right person to ask. So I was saying, well, why does nobody want to talk about religion? And Adila Razak, who is a young journalist now in the UK on Chevening, she said to me, well, the reason why people say, oh, I'm not an expert on Islam, goes back to the fact that here there's one Islam and nothing else is accepted. So because of that, it is sensitive because you're so scared to say something wrong. Well, why is it different in Malaysia? Well, this goes back to colonial history. The Dutch, who colonized Indonesia, you know, they didn't care about Islam, as long as they didn't want, like, political Islam, but they didn't care about the practice of the religion. And so in Indonesia, religion has always been outside of government power. Malaysia, it's been different. Under the British protectorate in colonial Malaya, or in British Malaya, the British, their attitude was, okay, well, we'll be in charge of politics and economics and the military. You sultans, you can be in charge of Malay culture and religion, which of course they embraced. And to this day, the state and religion are fused in a way in Malaysia that Indonesians would just find shocking. So yes, the state decides who's a good Muslim and who is not. Shufian Shukur, who was another editor at Malaysia Kini, said, so I cannot say something because I'm not an ulama. You have to be approved. If you think you've gone through a religious education in the top university in India or Cairo, if you're not approved by this council of ulama and religious department, you cannot even teach religion. So, all right, so sort of to wrap up here, what have I found? As you know, for America, a lot of Americans are concerned that journalism, Islam, democracy, no way they can possibly be reconciled. Well, I found that that's not true at all. And in fact, every single journalist I talked to has thought about these things and tried to work them out. I actually, Republica, I find kind of interesting because, you know, supposedly they serve the entire Muslim community, which is not so easy. As Elba Damhuri said, yeah, our dilemma of serving all of Indonesia's Muslims when nobody agrees on what Islam should be. And then Harry Ruslan, a young guy, he said to me, you know, Ibu Janet, and so no matter what Republika Online includes, someone is angry. They complain via Twitter and Facebook, and they urge others to stop subscribing. Well, I actually like this. I think, you know, this shows that Republika, even though, yes, sometimes it's politically conservative and it can drive you crazy, that they really, you know, they really take very seriously the fact that they need to represent different points of view and that everyone is not going to agree with them and that that's fine. And so I think there's plenty of evidence of a kind of vigorous democracy here. I basically say that there is an Islamic idiom in explanations of journalism. And this is one of my favorite examples. Arif Zulkifli, whose picture I showed you earlier. Now, Arif, he just does not think I should be writing about tempo at all in this book. And he just keeps saying, you know, we're pluralists. We have nothing to do with Islam. And one trick that I've learned from narrative journalism, from the great writer John McPhee, is that when you're interviewing somebody, sometimes you have to be willing to look kind of stupid, you know, ask the same question several times. They may think you're dim, but perhaps on the second or third time, they'll get annoyed enough to give you a real answer. And this was probably the third time I'd said to Arif, who had been a student Islamic activist as an undergraduate. He'd been involved in the Da'wah movement. So I kept saying, are you sure you see no connection between Da'wah and your work as an editor at Tempo? And finally, he said this, I believe that I'm in this world to gather goodness, to invite goodness, that I will need as a supply of good things when I die. This is very Islamic, yeah? I have to do a lot of good things or invite good and forbid evil, Amar Ma'ruf Nahi Munkar, so that later when I die, it won't all have been for nothing. I believe in life after death. I believe that each person will be held accountable. I am perhaps not a good Muslim in terms of having a ritual. I'm not perfect in that regard. But I believe that what I write, what I report, what I have done for Tempo are good things that I can be proud of after I die. And this is from the guy who said that religion has nothing to do with journalism, nothing at all. I'm like barking up the wrong tree. So I don't think so. I think I am right, and I think this is actually additional evidence of it. Okay, finally, for sort of my public diplomacy State Department pitch, I have often been asked to speak about the role of a free press in a democracy. In fact, pretty much every public affairs section in the world, American public affairs section, that's what they want me to talk about, the role of a free press in a democracy. Well, I think both of those words are really problematic in a lot of the Muslim world, certainly in Indonesia and Malaysia, that people say, you know, how free is your press? Or how democratic are you? You've got this crazy guy in the White House, you've got, you know, the couple crazy guys ago, you had the weapons of mass destruction, that wasn't true. You know, your press is not so free, and you're not so democratic. And, you know, if we don't want your kind of freedom. If you freedom like you, we'll have prophets of the cartoons of the prophet, we'll, and pornography. And so then I'm in a position of having to sort of defend pornography, or, you know, you're talking about pornography and cartoons, and that's not the point at all. So I've actually learned that This is to me the sort of useful takeaway from what I've learned for our State Department friends, which is that better, rather than talking about the role of a free press in a democracy, better to talk about the importance of independent media in a democratic society or in a good society, because independence is an Islamic concept, whereas freedom is not. And now, this is a picture of a young woman who had just voted in Indonesia. She had voted for Jokowi, which is the number two on the ballot. She's very happy about that. Indonesia is democratic, and this is Zaki Akoya, the one whose sister is the lawyer of Anwar Ibrahim. Zakia and many of the journalists I interviewed are not liberal. But they are nevertheless tolerant. They accept pluralism. It's a sort of a different lens, a different nuance to doing good journalism. And I think, you know, it's important for us to understand. So finally, the last principle of journalism that I ever talk about is one I think it's very important, that journalism's practitioners have to be allowed to exercise their personal consciences. This is also from the Project for Excellence in Journalism. And I think this is very similar to a really important Islamic teaching, which is that whoever sees a wrong and is able to put it right with his hand, let him do so. If he can't, then with his tongue. If he can't, then in his heart. And that's the bare minimum of faith. And I actually found, I first heard this when I was writing about Tempo, but where I heard it, where it resonated, was at Bernama, the national news agency of Malaysia. I'd, you know, given some talk on journalism to young journalists, and afterwards, several of them came up and said to me, you know, how can we practice good journalism when the government is so, you know, controls everything? How can we be true to our consciences? And so, you know, I'd always say, well, first of all, I'm not really in a position to tell you this, but something to think about. You know, I'd repeat all this, and then I'd say, you know, maybe covering parliament or national politics is not the best way to work in keeping with your conscience, but there's plenty of other things you can report on. You can report on health or education or other social issues that you can still be a good journalist in keeping with your conscience. You know, so I was really interested in how this resonated, and I think for journalists who work in authoritarian regimes, it can be useful. So that's really all, and I'm happy to entertain any questions or comments. I know we have a lot of people with a lot of really great experiences here, so thank you.
Janet, thank you so much for
thank you.
Your talk. Taking us through what I would call a kind of very illustrative research that you have undertaken. If I may ask the first question as sure. The chair. You know, you talked at the end about working in authoritarian regimes and exercising freedom of press or independence mm-hmm. of journalists. To what extent, when you look at the role of Islam, because even with Tempo, ultimately, you saw the Islamic tint in mm-hmm. his thinking, I wonder how, you know, if there is, did you find instances of censorship, and does that, that censorship, does it come in Indonesia and Malaysia from an Islamist lens on it, or is it much more political? And if so, to what extent do these newspapers, do you see the degree to which there are differences in how they see their own independence being related to how Islamic they're perceived to be or not?
I'm really glad you asked that because, first of all, I only looked at independent media. I'm not sure this is all.
Oh, no.
I only looked at independent media, because often Indonesians and Malaysians say, why did you pick these publications? They're all independent. And it's hard to find independent media in Malaysia. PAS is an opposition party, so it's not controlled by the government. It's therefore independent. So their newspaper's independent. Malaysia Kini is independent, and the three Indonesian publications are.
There is censorship in Malaysia, but it comes from the government. It comes from it's political. It's not from within Islam. That it can have the guise of Islam if it's via the government. One of the things, Malaysia is so interesting and so complicated because everybody is trying to out-Islam each other. You know, like who has the authority to speak for the Muslims? And that's a whole separate issue, but in terms of the publications that I have looked at, there is no censorship from religion. In fact, they're all independent and report whatever they want. In Malaysia, there's significant attempts at censorship from the government, but this is why I don't look at government-controlled publications, because they're just not very interesting. You know, I wouldn't trust what I would find there, just because they're so busy trying to keep the government happy. And also, I don't think I would have access. Well, I know I wouldn't have access.
I ask because some of I know is Pakistan, where there is a certain pressure to keep within certain Islamist principles if you're critiquing Islam, for example, or certain practices as frowned upon. And, you know, you can get... you can make your life very difficult.
Oh, I would love to study Pakistan. I think it would be really interesting to see if I could find the same things there. I see what you mean, and I think when Stephen Gann tells me, don't quote me on Islam, I mean, he's Chinese-Malaysian, and as he said, anything I say can be used against me. But that's political pressure. That's not... I think it's very difficult in Malaysia to separate out political pressure from Islam because it's the government uses Islam as a way of, you know, the way of pressuring and censoring people. But I think the fact that Stephen also didn't want me to use the word secular because that might get him in trouble. It's a good question.
Okay, thanks very much. Let me open it up to the audience, and if you don't mind stating your name and your affiliation before you ask a question. You can be louder, but
Tova Norlin, assistant dean for research here at the Elliott School. So I was also interested in how this can be generalized, especially to the Middle East, of course, because that's a conflicted environment, and especially when it comes to political Islam. And then I guess I have a follow-up question that's a little different. That's very different, actually, completely different. How much did you, in writing this book and doing the research and in preparations for it, actually delve into spiritual writings and an understanding of Islam? I just have never asked you that question, but that would really fascinate me to know some more about.
Okay, I'll answer your second question first, that I always make it clear that I'm not an expert on Islam. I'm an expert on journalism. But I recognize differences in the way people talked about journalism right away. And so I feel very confident in that. And, you know, people told me all sorts of interesting things about their religious views, and all of which I enjoyed, and I learned a lot. But in the book, I keep a really tight focus on journalism because, you know, as you know, I'm not a Muslim. So actually, the only person who asked me if I was a Muslim was that Chinese-Indonesian owner of Republika. And he said, you know, we can't jump to conclusions. So I actually like that. So Yeah, I would love to, I mean, in fact, this is really my future research agenda. I would love to find out more, probably first in the non-Arab Muslim world. I'm really interested in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. I would love to learn more about journalism there. I've been to Bangladesh. I suspect that I would find a lot of the same things. You know, this is sort of an aside, but when I started this, it took me a long time to write this book, and one reason was for a long time I wasn't sure I was right. As all of you know, for a scholar, you find something new, no one's written about it, you think, wow, I've hit a gold mine. But then you also think, wait, why has no one else written about this? Am I seeing something that's not there? So I really wasn't sure. Then I, again, as part of like speaking for the State Department, I had often been asked to speak about journalism at Islamic institutes and universities in Indonesia, which are run by the state. And I discovered really early on that journalism there is taught in the da'wah faculty. Again, the kind of the call to God faculty, the missionary faculty, the proselytization faculty. Why would that be? Well, it turns out its history has to do with Muslim broadcasting. To teach somebody to be a televangelist, they need to have good communication skills. They need to learn how to be on the radio. They need to learn how to write things. And so that's where journalism is situated, not in the arts and sciences, but in the da'wah faculty. And it turned out so I went back to, I think, five of these universities where I'd been before, and I, you know, offered to give a lecture, and then I talked to the faculty. Turned out all of them had written these little books on journalism and da'wah, and they said in these little books the same things that the journalists had told me. So I thought, I'm right. And they said, you know, they also would use Western textbooks, you know, kind of old journalism textbooks from the United States, but they said, The textbooks are the same, it's the context that's different. So that's when I realized, yeah, I am onto something here that oddly nobody has really paid any attention to. So I would love to see if it's the same elsewhere. I did have some experience I've been to Sudan and Egypt when I was working on this, and I saw enough evidence to think I'm probably right, but I don't speak Arabic, and so I need to figure out a way to find some brilliant grad students who'd be interested in helping me. But Pakistan and Bangladesh and India and Afghanistan are other places I'd like to go.
All right, keep moving. Yes, in the back.
My name is Hakim. I'm a graduate student here at the Elliott School. Thank you for the brilliant presentation. The slides appeared black and white in terms of color, but the substance was much more richer. And
oh, thank you.
So that was just a... Your experiences should definitely has required a lot of work and thinking. And so from your experiences, when you look back at media, different sources of media in the United States, how did your experiences impact your views as a scholar when you came back, and are there areas that you would like to that have caused you to think about, and you know, their implications for public understanding here in the United States about international affairs?
That's a really good question. Wow.
Thank you.
I have thought a lot about this. Part of the "am I seeing something that's not there" question was, well, what about religion in the U.S.? What about journalists here? Maybe they're religious too. And I think one big difference is that in the United States, journalism is seen completely as a secular occupation, that you could be very pious yourself, but you see your work as secular. And I think a big difference in Islam, you know, people are always saying Islam is a way of life. Well, it is a way of life, and so I think on the one hand, if I were to talk to Muslim firefighters and nurses and doctors and, you know, trash collectors, that they might see their work as part of da'wah, you know. So that's one thing. On the other hand, what about religious journalists here in America? There's a very interesting study by a scholar named Douglas Underwood, who he wrote a book with a great name from Yahoo to Yahweh, but he did this survey where he asked he gave them Bible verses, and he said, how relevant are these verses to your work? Not at all, no relationship. Then he gave them aphorisms that have some kind of religious content, like The purpose of journalism is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Well, everybody thought that had great relevance to their work. So part of it is just religion. That journalism here is seen as secular, and no matter how religious you are in your private life, you're not going to say, "Oh yes, this is part of my service to God or part of my worship." That people don't say that. Maybe they do if they work for a religious publication, but mainstream journalists just aren't going to do that. So that was one difference. The other thing that I was really impressed with was this idea that journalism should be inspiring. And it does mean more than just publishing some happy news. It's the idea that we are obligated to try to make people better. And so how can journalism do that? And that's an element of journalism we just don't have here. Although I have noticed the Washington Post has this little section called The Inspired Life, where they will find stories of people who have made a huge difference. So it may be an impulse here, but it's not a primary impulse. We don't have something called journalism of the prophet here. We just don't do that. But it was, I've heard lots of people talk about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
My name is Ken Dante, and I worked as a therapist, but I've been interested in interreligious dialogue, but I've been following in Washington the thread of how religion enters in to journalism. And there are a couple of people that do that very, very well. Michael Garrison, who was, I think, Bush's speechwriter at one point, and Mark Shields. They're both Catholic, and they're part of kind of the social gospel Catholicism.
Right.
And they do weave that into their work. On the other side, and much of this through Facebook, it's like watching the religious right and their voice. So it's always grounded in some kind of religious thought or some prophetic thing, even if it's not overtly said,
right,
just what, as you mentioned, it's there. And, you know, so there is a ground where more of this is entering, and I'm thinking that more of this will enter over time. Maybe that secular domain and boundary has eroded a bit in the past 5 or 10 years. And maybe that's to the surprise of many people who are very secularist and say, no, that's not.
Yeah, it could be. That's interesting. I mean, I guess one of the things that really inspired me in doing this research was that I saw how generous everyone was with me. And I felt like I've seen something that a lot of Americans never get to see. And I've seen a side of Islam that Americans never think about. We certainly does not get highlighted. Even the people who wrote for Sabili were so generous with their time, because they knew I was sincere. They hoped I was sincere. Sort of on faith, they assumed I was sincere. I might not have been. I might have been there to... I represent everything they don't like. And also the threat of undermining Islam. That's what everybody's worried about. And I think one thing... Actually, the Sabili people like my book, which I was quite surprised to find. But I took them seriously. And I also recognize that they have a point when they see the Ford Foundation, the State Department, Westerners trying to undermine political Islam. Yeah, to some extent we are. To some extent we are. So they've got, you know, that we talk a lot about how we can't, nation building is bad, but we do a lot of religion building, don't we? We support moderate Islam, you know, and which just annoys the heck out of my friends. Like, why are Americans deciding what part of our religion to encourage? So, you know, part of, if I have a hidden message, it's like, hey, look at what is going on in Southeast Asia, that there's a lot of ferment here. These are wonderful people who have, you know, who think really deeply about profound issues. And they may think differently than we do, but this is worth paying attention to and valuing. So that's sort of my hidden agenda.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
Thank you for your talk. My name is Brandon Beardsley. I'm a graduate student in the Elliott School. I have a question about Indonesia and the relationship between state and kind of the Islamic press. After the Ahok blasphemy case, like, how do you see the future of the relationship between the Indonesian government and, let's say, Islamic press within an Indonesian context.
Yeah, this was a very interesting case where the governor of Jakarta, who's Chinese and Christian, was accused of blasphemy, and it was completely trumped up charges. It was he was misquoted, and a video was edited to make it sound like he was mocking Islam, and he was not. And everybody knew this. So it was a political thing to bring him down. There were attacks on him partly because he's Chinese-Indonesian and partly because he's Christian, and all of this was really bad. And the state acted in a very cowardly way. There's no doubt about it. Political Islam has become strengthened in Indonesia. And actually, a very interesting case that's less complicated that I can talk about is, I guess 3 weeks ago today, Tempo magazine, the one that's liberal, progressive, cosmopolitan, they were demoed against by, I think it was about 2,000 members of the Islamic Defenders Front, FPE, came to their news office on Friday after prayers, demanded to see the editor, and demanded an apology for a cartoon that appeared to make fun of their leader, who is now in self-imposed exile out of the country because he was caught sexting to some, he's married, and he was sexting to some other woman to whom he's not married, and so he's now out of the country, so he's not going to be facing charges. There was nothing on the cartoon to suggest it was this guy, other than that he was wearing a turban and a long white robe. And in the cartoon, he's talking to a young woman who's wearing a sleeveless outfit, and she's saying something which is actually a quote from a movie, and I forget exactly what the quote was, but can't remember exactly what it was. There was nothing to indicate it was this guy, which of course is the problem with reacting angrily to satire, because it indicates that you know you're being satirized. So this was quite a show. 200 or 2,000 Islamic defenders, the police, the Tempo editors, they were all there, and everybody acted exactly in character. The Islamic defenders is like, we demand an apology, you've insulted our leader, and Tempo's saying, take it to the press council, follow the legal procedures, we're not going to apologize, there's nothing here to insult your leader. Everybody acted completely in character. Finally, Tempo, the editor, kept saying, we will give you a right to reply. Finally, the editor apologized if they had hurt someone's feelings, but they never apologized for the cartoon. So, yes, political Islam is big now, and they are pressuring people like Tempo. And the role of the government, sometimes they just sort of stay out of it because they don't want to be held hostage by this either. So yeah, it's kind of worrisome. But I'm interested. I was fascinated by this most recent episode because I think, again, everybody acted exactly in character, including Tempo. They kept saying, follow the civil procedures. This is not the way to handle a dispute. You don't demonstrate against someone and extract an apology. Although they did sort of apologize, although not really. So it was interesting. It's not a good answer to your question, but it's a troubling time, I think, now in Indonesia. It's worse than even when I was doing my research.
All right. If you have no other questions, let me just say that I, for one, I found your comment about religious freedom versus independence being very insightful, because in many ways here, when we think about religious freedom, you have commissions on religious freedom, indices that show which country has more religious freedom or not, and so forth. But it seems to me that the independence you can still perhaps have within a context where there's religion is common,
right?
But there's independence from power. I think that's actually
key.
Is a very important thing to know.
And that's
for
an Islamic concept too. Yeah, I think if I were advising the State Department, I would say, the way to help promote press freedom is actually to promote independent media. Mm-hmm. That is. First of all, it's more accurate, and you end up not defending pornography and cartoons of the Prophet, which is, those are side issues, and those are also things that groups like Sabili just love, because, you're just playing right into their hands. Here come the Americans, defenders of pornography and cartoons of the Prophet. And that's not the point. The point is media that can comment independently on the government. That's a separate issue, and that's what you want to talk about.
Right, right. And now that you're going to be moving forward, perhaps into South Asia, I'd be, for
That's
one,
great.
Looking forward to your next book.
Well, I may be talking to you about
Pakistan,
who to talk to.
So please join me in
thanking Janet Steele.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I appreciate it.
And I should mention that I want to thank the Elliott School's Office of the Dean for also supporting the Elliott School book launch. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Very good.
Yeah, well, it is interesting that